Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, returning, is Vaughn Scribner. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. And we're talking about another book that he's written, Incivility, Urban Taverns, and Early American Civil Society. Vaughn, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, I couldn't be happier. Thanks, Mark. I'm really excited for this.
This is an unusual focus for a history study. How did you come to it?
All right, so it's kind of a funny story. When I was in graduate school, my first semester, they told us we needed to start thinking about what we might want to write our dissertation on. And I kind of came up blank at first, but at the time I was rereading one of my favorite books, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, and there's a passage in there about this tavern.
Oh yeah.
And how people come from all over the place, and it's the one place to get news and all this stuff. And I thought to myself, well, I know there are taverns in colonial America, which was my place of my studied. And so that's kind of what sparked it. And from there, I just started looking around, and the very first diary that I checked out from the library is by a guy named Dr. Alexander Hamilton, not the guy from the play. He was a physician. And right off the bat, he's going to these taverns all over the Eastern Seaboard in 1744. And he ended up kind of becoming, if I had a main character of my book, it would be him. He's not really. But it all kind of fell into place from there. So, you know, one of my favorite books kind of guided me on my way there.
I love that story.
Well, pretty nerdy.
It's nerdy, and that's what makes it great. Story itself is really fascinating because these sort of upscale taverns, which were literally all over colonial America, were places where people came and discussed ideas and sort of hashed things out, and different things would happen at them. But they were also important societal filters, and that's a term from your book. Talk to me about what that means.
Yeah, so in theory, it's all about theory versus practice. And I find that this links towards our modern-day society as well. So in theory, you have these elitist men in colonial America who wanted to use these taverns to order society around them. Taverns were the most numerous, popular, and accessible public spaces in the colonies. And so they're ubiquitous in this way. But they weren't supposed to be – they were everywhere, but leaders didn't want them to be for everyone, if that makes sense. So in their minds, they wanted just basically themselves to be in there and anyone they deemed civil enough, which was mostly white, middle, and upper-class men. They wanted to kind of bar black people, Native American, women, lower class white people, servants. But that was their theory. That's how they wanted it to go on paper. But it didn't translate to the pavement that way. Instead, you have all these licensed and unlicensed taverns proliferating in urban centers in the colonies, where people who are otherwise kind of theoretically barred from civil society are accessing these public spaces and using them not just as a place to like drink and talk, but also as a way to kind of thumb their noses at these elitist ideas of civility and order and difference in the colonies.
These elitist taverns are really interesting places. They're places where, as you write about, they sort of want to make a new Britain in America.
Yes.
And they see like they're constantly bombarded by the savagery of the new world environment, but they're going to hold it together. They're going to plot out the new thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and this is something that these, and I say elitist colonists because these white men who consider themselves elites in the colonies would not have been considered elite in Great Britain. Most of them worked with their hands. None of them were aristocrats. They didn't come. They weren't these landed gentry. But you're getting to this really core idea of, especially by the 18th century in America, is these elitist men especially are trying to recreate their idea of what's so great about the old world in the new world. They're wanting to build their cities up. They're wanting to have their own taverns. They're actually oftentimes named after taverns that are in London. They're doing the same things with pleasure gardens and spas. And the problem, though, that they run up against, especially in their minds, is there is all this, quote, savagery in the New World, whether it's Native American peoples, it's all these strange flora and fauna and these strange climates that can affect their bodies and minds in negative ways, and the landscape. And the fact of the matter is that they themselves, not only are they not aristocrats, but they're 3,000 miles away from the king. So they're always trying to almost, another scholar, Brendan McConville, has argued, and I kind of agree with him in this, that they in a lot of ways were even more British than British people living in England, because they're always trying to overcompensate to show how British they are.
Now, these upscale urban taverns were really dynamic spaces, and they offered a wide range of services at these taverns. First of all, they were key social filters. Women were often licensed to run these taverns, weren't they?
Yes.
And that sort of seems weird that the women aren't allowed there, but they can run them.
Yes. This is a world of contradictions, Mark. It still is. Our society still is, but it's a perfect example with women, where women generally were barred from taverns as customers. The only way these taverns were supposed to be very hyper masculine spaces. The only way a woman was going to be in there as a customer is if maybe she was with her husband at a ball or something. At the same time, they were expected to work in taverns as servants. Often prostitution really was a popular pastime in taverns. But then, interesting, then you flip it on its head again, and women throughout the Northeast and the South are regularly running their own taverns. And this gives women a power in colonial American society that they don't have otherwise, where you're running your own licensed tavern. Not only are you selling food and alcohol, but various other services. You're renting out carriages and carts and horses. You are lending people money, bartering goods, managing men and women who work for you. And so it's a really this key moment there. And also you have women running unlicensed taverns as well.
Well, we'll talk about the unlicensed taverns in a bit, because seems like where I'd be hanging out. I'd be hanging out in the unlicensed ones.
That's where all the crazy stuff's happening. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
These taverns were also geared to specific groups. So, for instance, there'd be a group of businessmen or local dock workers or something like that. There'd be a tavern just for them.
Totally. And that's an important point you make there, because I think oftentimes it's easy to think about the tavern as this place where, and this does happen, but, everyone just comes in and they're all best friends just because they're in the same place. And that wasn't the case. But you have these, just as we do today, you have these people who want to congregate with people like themselves.
Right.
In fact, one of my colleagues from grad school, now wife, she's a psychologist, and she did a study in Lawrence, Kansas, where she found that it got published as a published paper that people, the more they drink alcohol, the more likely they are to congregate with people that they see as like them. And so she did this study in bars in Lawrence, Kansas, a college town. And so I think the same thing was happening then. And you have these specific taverns intended for specific customers, according to class, what their job was, where they were from. You have taverns that try to cater to people from like Germany originally or Scotland. So, yeah.
What I love reading in this book is how important coffee was to the image of being upscale.
Yeah, totally. They take these coffee houses are really sprouting up in the 17th century in London, and by the 18th century, they're huge. And in the colonies, they see this term coffee house as this kind of, it's a marker of, class and urbanity. So they claim the name. They'll call places coffee houses, but coffee's not even their main seller. But it's another one of these ways to try to kind of show like, oh, look how connected we are, and this is an exotic thing, and we can sell it here. But also most people are still going to be drinking alcohol within the confines of the coffee house.
Now, these Inns really did a lot of other things. They hosted balls. They hosted dinners. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something that's mentioned in your book, and I had no idea what the hell this was.
Okay.
They hosted turtle frolics?
Yeah, those... Those were,
you didn't explain that in the book. You just sort of
it goes right by,
and all of a sudden it's like, what, turtles?
Yeah, it was a huge party where they'd get a bunch of turtles and kill them and eat the meat. So that's from what I've gathered. They just was like a almost like a where I live in Arkansas, we have these like crawfish boils.
Okay, all right,
all right. It's the same kind of deal where they get these. They just kill a lot of turtles and have a big turtle eating party.
So
as far as I know,
it's not much of a frolic for the turtles.
No, it's not a frolic for the turtles. The turtles are they die for the frolic to happen. Yeah.
Now they were also unofficial postal centers too. So these inns really did everything.
They really did. And when I have a whole lecture that I go, you know, I use the tavern kind of like break down my book and use it as a way to show my students how colonists were trying to connect with the world around them. And the thing I usually say is that, you know, we don't have anything like the tavern anymore, the colonial American tavern anymore now. It was basically this all-in-one. It was almost like the internet.
Yeah.
The 18th century. The Postal Service was incredible. I also say, you know, we take for granted how good our Postal Service is now, especially compared to an 18th century where you could go to your tavern in Philadelphia, and the way it worked is if you wanted to get a letter to London, a ship captain would hang up a bag in the tavern and you'd put your letter in there. The ship captain was going to London and you put your letter in there with directions of like who you wanted to get to and how, and you'd hope it got there. It would have stopped off in multiple taverns along the way and would have been open probably by the time the recipient got it. Otherwise, you wanted to hope that you maybe knew a ship captain or you had someone you trusted who could take it with them overseas. But intercolonial wise, just between and among the colonies, taverns were the post offices until towards the end of the 18th century. They were major postal centers.
It's fascinating because they also served as auction houses, as business centers, and they would exhibit stuff. And you have some great examples, like they would exhibit wax effigies and a camel was exhibited in one of them.
Exactly.
There was this wild thing where they just exhibited a big pile of sugar.
Yeah. I mean, they did all kinds of stuff. I found they'd have trapeze acts at taverns, all sorts of things because, you know, colonists, just like us now, were constantly craving spectacle and entertainment. And, you know, they didn't have these little phones like we do now. And books were much harder to come by then. Although taverns did offer colonists from all sorts of walks of life. Newspapers would have been littering the place and broadsides. But, and
again, from all over the world.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In a colonial newspaper, the first page was global news. It wasn't local news. Huh. It was all stuff that was going on throughout the rest of the world. These colonists were absolutely fascinated with what was going on, especially in England, because they considered themselves members of the British Empire in America. They didn't consider themselves Americans. They were constantly craving, you know, this news and this, you know, connection with what they considered their true kind of home, which was England. And this is something that eventually makes the American Revolution so radical, is that for them, you know, as something else I always say to my students, these men eventually who break away from, who lead the break from the British Empire were themselves staunch Britons their whole lives. Ben Franklin was in his 70s. He was the ultimate British colonist. And Ben Franklin, of course, was constantly using taverns to engage in all sorts of activities as well. So
you're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, returning, is Vaughn Scribner. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. And we're talking about another book this time around, In Civility, Urban Taverns and Early American Civil Society. Vaughn, talk about, there's this real attempt by people who are utilizing these taverns to appear or seem cosmopolitan. There's a big word.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's what they're going for. They don't want to seem like they're in a backwater. They are. Talk to me about them and the image of cosmopolitan.
Yeah, so this is a perfect transition from Benjamin Franklin. So you have these colonists who, like I mentioned earlier, are constantly worried about being seen by their peers, especially throughout the rest of the world, but also locally, as these kind of, like you said, these backwater, closed-minded people. Because the fact of the matter is they live 3,000 miles away from London. The largest city in colonial America by the 18th century is Philadelphia, with about 15,000 people. London at the same time had around 650,000 people. So they're constantly trying to show how worldly they are, but also how accepting of other people they are. So they love to say, I'm a citizen of no nation. I can go anywhere in the world and understand their customs. I can fit in. I'm like a chameleon. Now, this, of course, was a horrible contradiction once again, because at the same time that they're saying that, they're constantly lambasting people from other nations. They're constantly putting down, trying to show how much better they are than people that they consider lower class. So cosmopolitanism was this weird identity in the 18th century, because in one sense they're trying to say that they are a citizen of no nation, yet at the same time they're staunchly defending their Britishness and trying to show how British they are all the time. And so they're trying to use these taverns, especially tavern clubs where they meet with other men who feel the same way, consumables from around the world, to try to cultivate this cosmopolitan identity. But I argue that ultimately, in trying to do this, they only further cement their xenophobic nature and kind of their elitist feelings of difference.
Well, that was particularly true after the, as you write about in the book, after the French and Indian War, 1754 to 63. As you write, that really fanned flames of anti-French, anti-Catholic sentiments.
Totally. And that, you know, the anti-Catholic sentiments is something that went way back in England. They had something, they still have the Guy Fawkes Day. But the colonists brought that with them. In fact, the Bostonians celebrated Guy Fawkes Day, and the north and the south end of the town would get together in their own respective taverns and get liquored up. And then they'd each have these like giant kind of floats with an image of the Pope on them. And they'd march towards the center of the city and they'd meet there and fight. And whoever won got to take the other one's float and then light it on fire. And so it's like this very staunch, and you know, visitors to the colonies would, I have these great sketches that one of them did. The Swissman came and he saw this happening and he's like, what is going on? And so there's that kind of down, but that was more in New England.
Great.
but after the French and Indian War, this anti-French sentiment, it was really booming, an anti-Catholic sentiment, and it was throughout the colonies then. It became a real issue. But then, of course, we go back to contradictions. By 1779, 1780, these colonists who had once hated the French, they said, now they love them because they ally with the rebels during the American Revolution.
I know.
So,
well, and the other thing they emphasized, these upscale taverns, were gentility. So what I love of this, you describe in the book, that even the things that are in mahogany as a wood, spelled gentility. They would have pottery and glassware from around the world, China bowls, everything to emphasize, again, gentility, but also that cosmopolitan aspect.
Yes, and that they really are oftentimes kind of, they're so concerned with being seen as a, quote, gentleman. A young George Washington writes out all these rules of etiquette. You can still go look at them. Over 100. And it's everything from, all right, if you're sitting down at a table and there are five people there, and you automatically have to know, like, okay, this person's of higher rank than me, so he needs to sit here. Or if you're walking down the road, the person of highest rank walks closest to the wall instead of the road so they don't get splashed. And so, and then they transfer this to their material goods, but these material goods are arguably even more important in the colonies than they are in England.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in England, you have aristocrats where people know, okay, this is this lord. But in the colonies, you don't have landed titles, so they're constantly trying to use material goods, what they wear, what they're consuming, what kind of furniture they have, to show how wealthy they are.
Now, I have to talk about disorderly houses, because as I read that, I go, that's where I want to hang out. These are the places where the, quote, unruly masses went. Yes. And this is where there's, quote, wenching, drinking, rioting, and blaspheming. Yes. I think the weirdest thing is what they drink separates the two. Oh. So in disorderly houses, you could drink rum, but that's frowned upon in the upper-class taverns.
Yes, in the upper-class taverns, well, you could drink rum in the upper-class taverns, but it had to be through something called rum punch, basically, which was it was rum with some sugar and citrus and spices and a little water thrown in to kind of cut the taste. But upper-class or self-professed upper-class colonists consider themselves above just straight rum consumption. That was for the lower sorts, the Native Americans, who couldn't handle their liquor otherwise. So it was this crude craft drink in that way. But in the lower class taverns, the rules were all thrown to the wind, basically, in the lower class taverns.
There was gaming, illegal trading.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where ordinary women often ran these unlicensed taverns. Now, the amazing thing, and you talk about this, is there was this thing, this phrase called going upon the rake, went upon the rake.
Yes.
Upper class people, or people who considered them upper class, would often go to the disorderly houses to basically just get violent.
Yes, and it goes back to these contradictions again. So these very men who are trying to rule society and say they're above it, they get together and they do it in groups. Oftentimes they'd be donning a sword, which was this very elite thing to do. The lower classes couldn't don a sword. And they'd basically go out with their friends and get liquored up, and they'd go to these, what, you know, it's almost like a, quote, dive bar, these places where they usually wouldn't be ever go, but they'd use it as a power play. They'd go in, they'd bust up the tables and chairs, they'd accost women, and they'd drink profusely, then through, you know, break bottles, and they'd attack people as well, and they were proud of it. One guy, after he went upon the rake one night with his friends in Boston, was proud to say that they'd basically run a lot of the lower class people out and taken the tavern over for themselves, and then they'd make the lower class people come back in and start playing music for them. And they do this oftentimes without almost any punishment, a slap on the wrist at best, and this becomes celebrated throughout the British Empire, where there are these books written about going on the rake and little fun books. So it's almost like it becomes this sick national pastime.
Wow.
And you still see it going on. I mean, as we're talking right now, especially yesterday in London, there was mass chaos after England lost the Euro final.
Yeah.
And these people just spilled out in the streets. And this is this tradition in this way. But in this instance, in the 18th century, it wasn't the, quote, unruly masses doing it. It was these leaders who were going out and doing it to really show, just as the lower classes were thumbing their noses at them by having these disorderly taverns or unlicensed taverns, now it's almost like them reacting and saying, okay, well, here's what we can do too. Here's showing our power over you at the same time.
Things start to change, and we're going to have to – we just have a few minutes left. We're going to have to go over quickly. But the Stamp Act really starts to change the discourse that's happening in these taverns.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's amazing to follow the story in your book. Like, all of a sudden there was this thing of sort of nouveau Britain going on in these upper-class taverns. But now, all of a sudden, people are planning major riots.
Oh, it's crazy. And it flips quick. what better place to plan a drunken riot than a tavern? And, you know, they were already these well-known spaces. But really, with the Stamp Act, people get their feelings hurt. But really, it's all about money initially. You have these a handful of elite merchants who don't like being told what they can do, basically, because you have to think about it. For most of the colony's existence, they kind of gotten to do what they wanted. They kind of gotten to eat their cake and have it too. And now suddenly the King of England is saying, well, this French and Indian War costs a lot of money. We need you guys to actually pay some taxes, which you haven't been doing. Never mind that the colonists had the highest, on average, the highest quality of life of anyone in human history up to that point, as far as like mass average. But once, and, you know, we still, I think we still see this in kind of this American attitude today where, well, you're not going to tell me what to do. And then from there, I think it just kind of all gets out of control really fast because you have these people riding in taverns. They're attacking their local governors and their local stamp collectors.
The stories in your book are amazing. I mean, there was an attempt in the beginning to try to sort of put on some kind of civil control by these elites, but that proved totally fruitless. Yeah. There was a case of, I think it was James Ingersoll, the Connecticut stamp.
Poor guy. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they spilled out of the tavern. They went to go get him.
Oh, yeah, they are going. I mean, eventually they're tarring and feathering these people. And, you know, they're beating them up. They're burning their effigies. Just seeing that Capitol riot in January.
It was the exact same thing. It was terrorism.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and that's what I talk about this in my book is like, growing up, we have this idea of the American Revolution. Here, there are these patriots. But according to our modern notions, like what they're doing beginning in 1765 is terrorism. They're terrorizing these people intentionally. The American Revolution really begins in taverns.
That's right.
Both literally and figuratively. They plan the Lexington and, you know, the attacks at Lexington and Concord in a tavern. The Marines are born in a tavern.
Yeah.
I oftentimes have veteran students who, when I talk about taverns, like, oh yeah, the Marines, because this is a big part for them. So the taverns are critical in the Revolution.
We're going to have to end it there. We're out of time. My guest tonight has been Vaughn Scribner, assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. And we've been talking about his fascinating book, In Civility, Urban Taverns and Early American Civil Society. Vaughn, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks for reading the book, Mark, and inviting me to talk about it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.